Just so thankful that you all are here. You make the trip every year. You volunteer. You're part of our community. You're part of our family. And for me, coming here as a kid back in the 90s, Theater in the Woods was always one of those really cool places you came to, and you got to see some of your heroes. And hopefully you all feel the same this week as well. We have a great lineup, so please come back. Keep joining us. First and foremost, we're going to talk again about EAA's 70th. Your MC for tonight is someone who I think is probably the best person in the world to do that, and that is Steve Boose. Steve Boose has not only been EAA family for over 25 years, he's been staff, he's been working on the grounds, different capacities, just a wonderful person and a wonderful wealth of knowledge when it comes to not just hosting this event or putting on the air show, but just organizational knowledge, institutional knowledge here at EAA. So let's everybody give a warm welcome to Steve Boose.
Good evening, everybody. It is an honor, as always, to be up here at the Theater in the Woods stage, and even more so because tonight we're going to talk about the 70th anniversary of EAA, and thought it would be a good idea to start with the guy who's in charge, Jack Pelton, our president and CEO. And Jack, how does it feel to be 70? I'm sorry. How does it feel for the organization to be 70?
There, because I'm too close to 70, but not actually that close. But anyway, you know, it's a very reflective time when you think about EAA hitting the 70th anniversary. And it's, you know, I've tried to talk to people about this week as far as the association's concerned, because we all get so wrapped up in Air Venture, because we're all here, it's a convention, all the members are here, and you keep not want to confuse the convention and its anniversary versus the history of the organization. You know, for me personally, it's really important, because I wouldn't be involved in aviation if it weren't for EAA. I mean, my dad was a member of Chapter 1 in California. Turned the aviation bug into me as a kid, and I've worked professionally in the aviation industry my entire life, and I never thought it would come back full circle to being in charge of EAA. And that's been probably one of the most rewarding assignments I've ever had in my entire life. But back to the whole 77th, by the way, he's in trouble because he knows I talk a lot. It's the accomplishments of what's happened over the last 7 years. And I think that's the reflective moment I have in looking at the vision Paul had when he got some like-minded home builders together to put together a group, a community and friends to advance the concept of home building, and then added in a fly-in. And I was telling Steve in some of the conversations we've had, I also like to study leadership. And what has amazed me about Paul and where EAA has gone is his leadership was one that he started with the concept around home building and let it evolve to where it is today. And what I look at that is he didn't put any boundaries on where it could go and what it would be and what it would represent. And I know our roots are in home building, but you look at it today and it's an association that really represents all aspects of general and recreational aviation, more so than any other organization in the world, and also has been probably one of the most effective advocates and supporters and working very diligently and hard to continue to grow the general aviation and recreational aviation in all of those disparate different areas. And it's really fascinating to think of how you can, as a leader, be able to do that as an organization and see that over that period of time, it's continued to grow and it's gonna continue to grow. We're at 280,000 members right now, and I'm probably safe to say we're close to, I mean, one, that's a record, but probably the largest aviation organization at this point in time, and representing the most diverse groups within aviation.
Excellent, congratulations. When do you think we'll hit 300,000?
300 will be probably
Friday?
By December.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that is amazing. I mean,
and it's the reason I say that is it's not, I'm not arrogant or any of that thing. We have, our youth programs are so strong, and that really brings in the youth membership element of it with our Young Eagles program and all of the other things we're doing. And that has just really going incredibly strong because of the Young Eagle program, but now Aero Educate, which we're bringing in. We hope to have 15,000 new youth memberships as a result of, and those are all free, as a result of what we're doing.
Yeah. You mentioned Paul, obviously Paul and Audrey, and the founders of this organization back in 1953. As leader, how do you continue to preserve that culture, the early culture of what makes EAA special, but yet work our way into the future? Because we have to evolve,
we do.
Right? And we have to meet the challenges. So as the man in charge, does that keep you up at night?
It certainly does. Because the thing, you know, the question you get a lot about is, okay, the culture. How do you, what creates culture? And culture does start in how you behave, how you interact with others, what your leadership style is. And we have to preserve that culture that Paul and Tom, and I have Tom's story certainly also, because we were very close, in how we interact, how we engage volunteers, kind of what our core value system is, how we, you know, here we are in 2023, and we're the most inclusive organization from 1953 on. If you look at the opening paragraph in the founding of the organization, it says everyone is welcome, doesn't matter about race, religion, or any of that, is actually in the founding. And it's like, and now we sit around as a nation, fight through all that different stuff, and it's like, we've been there. But you just live it, and that's a big part of it. And you've got to make sure that you lead and you demonstrate it that way. I think the evolve part is, where are we going with the new technologies, and how does that integrate into what we do? This week, we're gonna see an autonomous potential air taxi fly, Whisk. We have a lot of other AAM companies that are on site, and you can see that as another evolving avenue that hopefully will be on display here.
Well, and we saw the Pipistrel, Textron's Pipistrel, yep. Fly today, electric-powered aircraft. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know. It flew beautifully, and it just shows how, especially the battery technology, electric aircraft have evolved in the past few years. And again, EAA continues to embrace that.
And to support that, this week, while we're celebrating our 70th anniversary, we're also celebrating the public release of the Mosaic regulatory change that the FAA put out on Thursday for public to actually see what's in it. And it's going to be the most significant piece of regulatory change in aviation's history for the last probably 30 years, where it redefines what a light sport aircraft is, opening up very broadly to airplanes with no weight restrictions, just a stall speed restriction. No, speed is 250 knots, constant speed props, retracts, on and on and on, that you'll be able to fly as a sport pilot.
And that
and electric power plants and
power,
propulsion.
Yeah. Yes.
And I'm very proud of this organization and my team, because it was all conceived by EA and FAA sitting together in Kansas City at the Small Aircraft Directorate over a cup of coffee, where we went down there and we said, how do we expand LSA? How do we make this thing better? It took us a long time, but we got there.
Excellent. And which leads into EAA's always been philosophy, working with the FAA, working with, not against. Back in the early 50s, the FAA just about shut down home builders, mm-hmm. right? Paul went to Washington, made his case for why home building was safe, and then established that relationship, that non-adversarial relationship, and obviously continues today.
That is part of that, as we talk about how do we preserve the culture and keep it going forward. We really pride ourselves in relationship-based activism, if you will. We don't send out letters to members begging for money to have us be Washington, D.C. lobbyists. We go out, we have relationships, we meet with our counterparts, we talk through issues, and we try to find win-win solutions for things.
Excellent. And it definitely has paid dividends through the years.
It certainly has.
With you looking back, when was the first time, do you remember when you joined EAA? What year?
I first came to AirVenture in 78.
Okay.
And I was a newly minted pilot, but I came with my dad, and I was from Southern California. Don't hold that against me. I'm now a Midwesterner. Came to AirVenture back then, and at that time became a member, and so it's been a while.
Good.
And then probably now this is year 28 straight
for being at the show.
Yeah.
Okay. And you've now 10 years as the president?
This is year number 11.
11. Yeah. Okay. There's a reason I can't do math.
That's why you keep thinking I'm closer to the 70th anniversary in age.
As you look back at your time with EAA as a member, And this is the question of your pilot, what's your favorite airplane? What do you think is probably the major accomplishment that EIA has been able to do through the years?
Period through the years? Yeah. Mosaic will now be clearly the number one item. There's no doubt in my mind. That is the biggest change that's happened. And it's a buildup of the things EA did up to this time, because they were instrumental in getting basic med in place. They were instrumental in getting the LSA category of airplanes in place. This just now makes it even grander than that. And then, you know, back to the how do you keep things going? I always tell people, I'm never done. So it's what's next.
Right.
And maybe somebody else will finish it off, but you've got to keep looking out and saying where you want to go.
Good. If folks want to see more about the new legislation, can they find it on the website?
It'll be out on the website, and we've built a really nice kind of an easy, here's what used to be in place, and here's what's now in place, so people can see it and understand it pretty quickly. Our advocacy group over at the member tent on the Four Corners will have that.
Okay. Stop in and find out more about it. Yeah. Jack, let's bring out a few of our
guests.
Got
some interesting people.
Yes, we do. We do have some interesting people. Right now, I'd like to introduce Eileen Borkman from the Seattle, Washington area, another longtime EIA member. Eileen? See if they bring her out.
Here she comes.
Oh, okay. Also joining us tonight is John Dyke. If you're a home builder, you recognize John's name. Come on out, John. And also joining us tonight is Kermit Weeks. Yeah. All right, as John gets set, Eileen, tell us a little bit about your background. You really grew up with EAA, didn't you?
Well, not so much with EAA, but with general aviation. And I was certainly aware of EAA. My dad, from the time I was a fairly young child, had this dream of building an airplane that he designed when he was in college and intended to set a world record with it. And I was actually only kind of vaguely aware of that when I was a kid, but there was always airplane parts all over my house, you know. And my mother was a pilot as well. And so I actually resisted coming to Oshkosh for many years, I will admit that, because I grew up around air shows. My dad was in the Air Force, been in many air shows when I was a kid, had been in a couple air shows myself, and people would always say, you've got to go to Oshkosh, and I'd say, why? And so finally one year I gave in and I came here. It was in 1993, and I said, I'm going to come for one day, and at 5 o'clock when I was leaving, I was almost in tears because I wanted to stay, and I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I had to get back to work, and so that formed my total obsession with everything Oshkosh since then. So
you actually wrote a book sort of about your life experiences called A Propeller Under My Bed.
Yes, The Propeller Under the Bed. So yeah, it was actually my mother's bed. So yeah, she always used to say, if your father ever gets around to building that airplane, which he did finally, but if he ever gets around to building that airplane, I'm going to write a book called The Propeller Under the Bed. And unfortunately, she passed away before he finished the airplane, but I took up the charge and wrote the book for her, if you will.
Very good. Tell us a little bit about your dad and the airplane that he did eventually build.
So my dad, Arnold Ebnetter, the airplane's called the E-1. It's actually in the museum over here, if you want to go take a look at it. He designed it in college as a senior design project for his aeronautical engineering degree. That was in 1960. And the airplane was designed intentionally to set a world record. It was a point design just to set a straight line distance record. And he planned to build the airplane not long after he graduated and go ahead and set the record. Well, life got in the way. so 50 years later, he finally set the world record in 2010 when he was 82 years old. So,
wow.
So a great story of persistence. So
absolutely, never give up, right?
That's right, never give up.
All right, and professionally, you are an aeronautical engineer?
I am also an aeronautical engineer, yes.
That didn't have anything to do with the influences of your mom and dad, did it?
Well, I knew about aeronautical engineering. I was good in math and science, and it just seemed like the thing to do, so yeah.
Excellent. John, of course, John is the builder of the Dyke Delta. And John, what was the first year that that you flew your Delta?
What more again?
What was the first year you flew your Dyke Delta?
1962.
Yeah. All right. And I understand you might have gotten in trouble for that design with Lockheed and the F-117.
Yeah, we had some discussion about it. Yeah.
Well, John, you were working for Lockheed at the time, right?
Yeah.
All right. So go ahead and tell us the story of how they kind of called you on the carpet about that.
Say it again.
Tell the story about how Lockheed called you on the carpet about your design.
Well, I wasn't at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as an engineer, but not in aeronautics. I was a mechanical engineer. I was checking out a water system on a hangar, and I had to get the part numbers off this sprinkler system. So when this hangar, I had top secret terms at that time anyway, but I didn't activate it. So I had to climb up in the rafters to get this number. They sent two people out with big bunting about 10 feet long, and held on so I couldn't see down in the hangar. But while I was climbing, walking across these two bunnies, I got kind of unbalanced. I grabbed the bunny to keep them falling. And when they did, the 117 was sitting down there. And so all the bells started to blow and the whistles and fire and sirens started going off. And they said, we gotta put you in house arrest. Took me in town and started interrogating me. I found out I had top secret clearance anyway, so they activated it, made me part of the secret. So anyway, I said, I got one at home anyway. So they sent somebody out to look at it.
What did they think when they saw it?
What did they think when they saw your airplane?
Well, they just didn't say much. Just that really, the first 117 had folding wings, you know. Mine had folding wings also. So later on, they did away with the folding wings, you know, and then we made the prototype. And I said, I've been flying it now about 3 years. They was impressed, you know. I didn't offer no job, though.
And is it true that some of the Lockheed engineers had actually seen your plans?
Yeah.
So your plans for the Delta actually helped influence the 117.
Yeah.
So there you go. EAA in the house, right? Kermit Weeks, how are you this evening, my friend?
I'm doing awesome. Everybody else out there, I hope is having a great time too.
Yeah. What was your first exposure to EAA?
Oh my God. I met an airline pilot on the street that introduced me to somebody in Miami when I was 16 years old building a Starduster 2. He allowed me to kind of help paint some parts and stuff. I found a set of drawings. I became an EAA member when I was 16 years old. And I ended up building most of my first flyable airplane, the structure, last year of high school. Taught myself how to weld. I came up here for the second EAA in 71 at Oshkosh. And, you know, just kind of tried a little bit on the deal there and went home and, you know, basically kept practicing. I knew about penetration and all that stuff. I'd cut the welds and look at it. And then finally, you know, I'd weld a little T when I beat it, and the tube finally broke before the weld did. I certified myself as a welder, so I built an airplane. And then I went away to school for a couple of years and didn't get a chance to work on it. But eventually I went home, test flew it when I was 20, dropped out of Purdue University Aeronautical Engineering beginning of my sophomore year. I had no formal training, aeronautical engineering. And then I designed the weak special and the weak solution, won 20 medals in them at the world level, 2 times U.S. national champ. And then I started collecting airplanes, and it's all EAA's fault.
And it's interesting, for those who don't know, your start was really in the aerobatic area.
Yeah, you know, in high school, I was on my high school last year gymnastic team, and I was learning how to fly at the same time. And that was back, oh my God, I don't know if y'all remember this, but you could clip a coupon out of Flying Magazine and go get your first flight for $5, okay? So that hooked me. And since I was flipping around in the gym, I immediately gravitated towards flipping around in the sky, and, you know, the rest is history.
Quite an impressive history, mm-hmm. I must say. What's your latest project?
Oh my God, which one? I mean, I got airplane projects, you know, Fantasy of Flight's a big dream of mine to create something that doesn't really exist. I love the airplane people, you know, but I think everybody on the planet that loves airplanes is on this field, and the rest of the world doesn't know what we're doing. So I'm gonna go basically out and create something the rest of the world loves, but in a way that I'm gonna blow everybody else out there away that loves EAA, so.
That's good. With your history with Fantasy Flight, with EAA, what are some of the, I guess, the big things that stand out in your mind about EAA's history?
Well, you know, I was, when I first started coming up here, this wasn't, anything was going on. I was going to Burlington, the museum, when it was in there, you know, when they had the Gene and Bonnie were living on the airport, and, you know, and so I'd come up here and see Tom and Paul, and, you know, just FYI, the first building the EAA ever built here that was not a shower or a port-a-john has got my name on it on the other side of the field, way before the museum and stuff. And so, you know, Paul was a people person, and I see EAA as a people organization. Tom came along and kind of put some more corporate business structure to it, you know, and I think the combination of those two things made this organization the great thing that it is today.
It certainly is. And any plans for any new aircraft restorations that we'll see from you anytime
soon? Oh, my God. Well, I was trying to get an A-26 here,
right,
but it ended up slowing down, and Steve and the guys are down there, you know, with the Constellation trying to get that here, and Steve had been doing some test flying on mine. But I probably have 6 or 7 projects going on, but I'm also working on my long-term dream for Fantasy of Flight, you know, and people don't really understand what I'm trying to do yet, but at some point, I think when we get through what's happening on the planet right now and the dust settles, my clientele lies in the future. It's going to be a very, very different world one day, and there's a very, very bright light on the horizon. We just got to get through some of this BS right now.
Sounds good. And you're celebrating an anniversary as well, along with EAA.
Oh my God, EAA and I, 70 years old. I know I don't look it, but anyway, no. I still feel like a kid, so love it.
That's good. Jack, as we're looking through, you know, this week, we're obviously centered on everything that's happening here. But again, as you emphasized earlier, this celebration is not just Oshkosh-centric, it is EAA-centric. And what are some of the things that we'll see through the year?
We're going to continue to see growth in our youth education programs, Aero Educate, which is, I refer to that as the next step after you take the Young Eagles flight. And it's an online curriculum for not only the young person that took the flight, but also their parents and their teachers, with curriculum, and it's got programs where you can continue to learn in all aspects of aviation, not just being a pilot, it's being a mechanic, you know, being an engineer, all of those things to get spark the interest in aviation for young people. So that's the big, we finished our big project last year, which is the addition of the Youth Education Center. So that was kind of we're taking a little bit of a time out. And then we need to get our B-17 back in the air.
Ah, yes, another one.
Yeah.
What's the prognosis?
Prognosis is fine. We just have to build some parts and put it back together. And as anything, building parts, you know, you have to build tooling. Then you have to find the right metal for it. And the lead times are horrendous. I mean, we're looking at 40 weeks for certain things. So it's going to be a while. And then getting the volunteers and the labor to put it back together.
Right. Eileen, what are some of EAA memories that stand out for you?
Some EAA members. I would say, you know, in addition to the Poberesnys, obviously, Richard Van Groensven, you know, I think he has had a major impact, you know, not just the designs that he's had, but also the whole idea of kit building. You know, he wasn't the only one that was, you know, thinking about kits back in the day, but he was, I think, really the one that really, you know, kind of moved the idea of kits forward and really started pushing the boundaries on that. And then Kristen, the Kristen Eagle. So that aircraft is, you know, I think it's still probably the most iconic picture of a home-built aircraft ever taken. You know, this idea that you could literally have a box of stuff show up at your front door and then just start, you know, putting it together, right? So those are probably the two main ones that come to mind. I mean, there's just, you know, obviously hundreds and hundreds of people out there. But when I think of the two kits that probably had the most influence on kit building itself, those are the ones that come to mind.
So. You'd mentioned, Jackie, you'd mentioned Tom, and we had an unveiling ceremony for his statue this morning.
We did. This morning we unveiled in the museum a bronze statue of Tom. And if in the museum, there's always been a statue of Paul on the right-hand side when you come in. And now we have Tom on the left-hand side, and it was a beautiful ceremony and very fitting way to celebrate the one-year anniversary of his passing.
And Kermit, you were there as well?
Yeah, it was great, and Sharon was there and finished it out with some really great tearful comments about, you know, her experience with the AA. So it was worth going to. It's great.
And very emotional. If you haven't seen the statue, I have not either. I've just seen the pictures. But as I envision it, Tom is looking up at, as you mentioned, the Kristen Eagles that are in the lobby, kind of looking toward the sky.
He is, and that was I was aware of the iterations that they were doing because they had run them by and Sharon. The original iteration was one that had an eagle kind of tied to a Kristen Eagle tied to him, and she said, "Let's have Tom looking right up at his airplane," and they did a great job of capturing that. And they captured. Tom wasn't, you know, if you see most pictures of Tom's, he's not a big smile guy. And he only smiled, his natural smile was one of great affection when it was appropriate. And this is of him smiling, looking up at his airplane. Very, very well done.
And one of my enduring memories of Tom during the convention would be he'd be doing everything in the early days, everything from, in those days we didn't have the traffic patterns that we have now, and cars got backed up on Highway 41 and the State Patrol was mad and the Winnebago County Sheriffs were mad and everybody was mad. So Tom would get in the Bell 47, 90B, and he'd go out and literally direct traffic and get things straightened out and then turn around, land, come out here and jump into the Eagle and go fly with the Eagles. But he always had, when he got in that airplane, you could just tell he left the world behind. He had that smile on his face, yep. And away they went, and it made history. Kermit, we'll start with you. Any final thoughts as you look back at your involvement with EAA as we've got our 70 years?
I tell you what, it's interesting because, you know, sailing ruled the world 150 years ago, and it has no intrinsic value to society or purpose anymore, except for the intrinsic value, you know. And, you know, I was on the EA board for 21 years, and there was a period there where they were trying to come up with mission, vision, purpose. So, you know, they were kind of rehashing everything. And I was the only person about of 40 that voted against the mission that we were leaders in recreational aviation. I thought, oh my God, that's AOPA, that's not it. And they finally got it right. This literally is the spirit of aviation. You see it in all the different aspects of it, you know. I mean, originally it started out as a home building thing, then it got absorbed into classic jets and ultralights and, you know, warbirds and aerobatics and, you know, and all the other facets. And it's just not the same. And I look at, you know, the airlines, and I look at what's happening, and you see how the kids have kind of grown up and gotten into stuff. And, you know, this is the golden age of aviation that's left, you know, and the rest of it to me is just industry. It's great that it's safer and all that kind of stuff, you know, but the passion and the love and the just want to be part of everything and creating things with your hands, you know, it's EAA. Nobody comes close. Yeah.
I know there are a lot of folks in the audience tonight. Many of you are volunteers. It wouldn't be without the 6,000 volunteers that come help make this happen during this week, but also the volunteers around the world, around the year. I mean, everything from, you know, Young Eagle pilots and coordinators to technical counselors and the chapter leaders. So for all of those of you who volunteer in any sort of way, thank you for making this organization great. Give yourselves a round of applause. Eileen, how about you? What do you kind of see on the horizon for EAA?
On the horizon for EAA, I see more of the same, but always looking to the future, because I feel like that's what EAA has done throughout its history, is looking to the future, not just, you know, relying on the same old things that we've always done. And the thing that I think is just amazing about the home built industry is that, you know, you can buy a kit that you can assemble in just a few months that will go, you know, faster than any production airplane out there for general aviation, that's just as well built, if not better. It's got advanced avionics. It can do just about anything. But you can also still go get a set of plans for Pete and Paul and build that in your garage with hand tools and just a bunch of wood. Yeah. And so it's everything in between. And that's what I love about EAA, is because it's such a continuum. It gives you there's something for everybody here every year, And I see EAA continuing to expand that. So, and I have this fantasy that someday we're going to have home-built spaceships. So,
absolutely. And Eileen, I know it's after 5 o'clock. Did you have to get back to work today, or
yeah.
Can you stay for the rest of the week?
No, I'm good this week.
Okay,
today.
Good. Yeah. Jack, why don't you wrap things up for us?
Well, you know, I think as reflected by a lot of the comments made here, EA truly is a special, special place, special association, special people. It's why we all come here and spend time with each other. And as Eileen said, and Kermit, it has the ability to unlock in people the ideas and spark innovation of being able to build things themselves, restore things, get involved in things, learn to fly. There's something here for everyone. And that's that imagination that we need to create in young people to really help them grow and help them find their own way, which I think we're really good at it. And I think that we need to continue to make sure that's one of our focuses.
I agree. All of you, thank you for joining us. I know there are thousands and thousands of stories out there, and I encourage any of you, if you're walking the flight line and you see a pilot or a builder with their airplane, please ask them about it.
Yeah.
They are more than willing to tell you the story, and I think in a lot of cases, they're just hoping someone will come up and ask a question. So please do that, because it just continues to build on the camaraderie and the spirit of EAA, and that, as Jack said, that's one of the ways that we can continue to grow this culture and continue this organization. Kermit Weeks, John Dyke, Eileen Borkman, Jack Pelton, thank you all for being here tonight, sharing some memories. Let's go have a great week.
Awesome. Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good deal. All right, here we go.